and hospitalizations and death. I would assume that's what's going on there, but I don't have any particular reason to think that COVID is, quote, over in Russia. And I don't think the invasion of Ukraine has anything to do with COVID. If you have a different perspective, certainly let me know. Reminder, we are launching the David Pakman Show coaching. This is an interesting new project we're doing. I am going to try to help others grow their online platforms. So if you are already a content creator, okay, if you're not, this isn't for you. This isn't to teach people how to start. If you are already a content creator and you have a YouTube channel with an audience or a podcast with an audience, and you're all good on the production side and you want to participate in some group coaching, I am going to be coaching 4, maybe 5 people in a group format. You can sign up at davidpakman.com/coaching. You have to be willing to have our coaching sessions filmed, because then we're going to publish them to hopefully help even more people. Okay, that's the idea. If you're not interested, just don't do anything. I got 2 emails from people angry and they don't want to do it. But then don't sign up. If you don't want to be coached on growing an independent media platform, do nothing. Okay, but if you want to be, you can go to davidpakman.com/coaching, fill out that form. We've got a great bonus show for you today coming up right after this short break. Sign up at joinpakman.com to get access to the bonus show.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
WRCT in sound from way out.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
CT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
Folks, glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
More news from New York City. Immigrant rights advocates are celebrating the inclusion of coverage for all in the state assembly and Senate budgets. The measure extends health insurance to all New Yorkers, regardless of immigration status. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we remember Brent Renaud, the award-winning journalist and filmmaker shot dead in Ukraine on Sunday. Stay with us. The Odessa National Academic Theater Orchestra performing the Ukrainian national anthem during an outdoor concert this weekend called Free Sky, calling for peace and a no-fly zone. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Sunday, the award-winning U.S. journalist Brent Renaud died after being shot and killed near a Ukrainian checkpoint in the city of Irpin. That's just outside the capital, Kyiv, where there's been heavy fighting as Russian troops advance on the capital. Ukrainian officials accused Russian forces of killing Brent, though Agence France-Presse reports the exact circumstances are unclear. The Peabody Award-winning filmmaker was 50 years old. At the time of his death, he was with photographer Juan Arredondo, who was wounded in the attack. Arredondo briefly spoke to an Italian reporter from the hospital before he was taken into surgery.
Tell me, please, what is your name?
Juan.
Juan?
Juan.
Where are you from?
The U.S.
U.S. What happened to you?
We crossed the first bridge in Irpin. We were going to film other refugees leaving. Mm-hmm. And we got into a car. Somebody offered to take us to the other bridge. And we crossed the checkpoint, and they start shooting at us. So the driver turned around, and they kept shooting. It's two of us. My friend is Brent Renaud, and he's been shot and left behind.
And how is he?
I don't know.
You don't know. You don't know what happened to him?
I saw him being shot in the neck, and we got split, and I got pulled into the...
And who brought you here?
An ambulance. I don't know.
That was the photographer Juan Arredondo, who was wounded Sunday in a shooting in the Ukrainian city of Irpin, just outside Kyiv. At the time that he was speaking in the hospital, Juan didn't know that Brent Renaud was dead. Brent is the first foreign journalist known to have been killed in Ukraine since the Russian invasion. At the time of his death, Brent Renaud was working on a documentary for Time Studios about global refugees. In a statement, Time Studios said, quote, "We're devastated by the loss of Brent Renaud. As an award-winning filmmaker and journalist, Brent tackled the toughest stories around the world, often alongside his brother Craig Renaud." Over the past two decades, Brent had reported across the globe, including in Colombia, in Mexico, Egypt, Somalia, Iraq, Libya, Haiti, China, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Brent and Craig Renaud both appeared on Democracy Now! A number of times to talk about their films, including Off to War, about the deployment to Iraq of the National Guard from their home state of Arkansas.
We arrived in Baghdad with a National Correct. Guard unit, with the Arkansas National Guard, in these same sort of unarmored vehicles. Right away in April, which was one of the bloodiest months of the war, when we arrived, there were, right off the battle, a lot of injuries and deaths.
We were broadcasting from DCTV at the time. Brent and his brother Craig Renaud started their filmmaking career at DCTV, that's downtown community television here in Manhattan. For over a decade, Democracy Now! Was housed in the same old firehouse. In a statement, DCTV founder John Alpert said, quote, "We had the honor of working alongside Brent for many years. We were and are inspired by his commitment to bring his camera to capture scenes the world needs to see, no matter the difficulty or the danger. Brent is a hero who sacrificed for all of us. He deserves to be celebrated, not murdered," John said. Later in the show, we'll hear more from Brent in his own words on Democracy Now!. But first, we're joined by Anne-Marie Lipinski. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and curator of the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University. She got to know both Brent Renaud and Juan Arredondo when they were fellows at the Nieman Foundation in 2019. Anne-Marie Lipinski, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk
about
how you found out what happened, and our condolences also to Brent's family, to his brother Craig and the whole family, to you because you knew him, and really to the world because this is such a loss. Talk about Brent, how he came to Nieman and how you learned what happened, and then also tell us about Juan, who's been injured but is alive.
Brent, as you well know, Amy, was a very, very special journalist, yes, but also person. And I still remember the interview with him the year he applied to become a Nieman Fellow. And he always, he grew up as a shy and socially awkward child, and he still wore that as an adult. I think situations like an interview for a fellowship were difficult for him, more difficult than covering a war. But his central and just very sort of profound humanity came through in that interview. And his work obviously was excellent. And anyone who's watched any of his and Craig's documentaries can see that. But what you could also see in Brett was that he just brought a very, very rare humanity and patience to the work. He would tell us that the goal of his journalism was thoughtful stories about disenfranchised people. And I think he lived that credo every day. I found out he had been killed yesterday morning. I woke up simultaneously to a social media post and my phone ringing. Nate Payne, one of Brent's fellow fellows from that year at Harvard, was phoning me from Traverse City, Michigan, where he's editor of the local newspaper. He was a very close friend of Brent's, and he also had just heard the news. And so we were kind of finding out together. And a little bit later in the day, the class and I and another colleague from Nieman got together on Zoom and talked for a long time about Brent and his work and the impact that he'd had on journalism, of course, but really on all of us as individuals.
And can you tell us about Juan Arredondo? Clearly, when he gave that interview as he was being prepped for surgery, he had been whisked away to a hospital. Brent died on the road. He didn't know that his colleague had died. Tell us about Juan Arredondo.
Juan, like Brent, is just a really brilliant visual journalist. He was mainly a still photographer and really developed his videography, partly during his year at Nieman and really in good measure because of Brent. And they became very close. Not just friends, but partners on stories, and they have traveled together a number of times. I think what's remarkable about that video is you hear in Juan's voice, that is Juan. He's just the picture of calm and kindness and patience. And he sounds very much like he often does, although you can also feel the strain of what he has just been through. Our understanding is he went into surgery for what was believed to be shrapnel or a bullet in his leg, but that a bullet was not found. He has recovered from surgery. He will need to stay hospitalized for a handful of days. And then
is he in Poland or Ukraine?
He's in Ukraine. And there are people working to then evacuate him back to the United States and also to return Brent's body to this country.
Are you having trouble? Is the family having trouble getting Brent's body back?
I don't know that they are having trouble. I know that there are people working on this, including another fellow from that. There were two fellows in that class who are Ukrainian. And so there's a lot of support and a lot of people working on this to return him home.
I want to turn to look at some of Brent Renaud's remarkable work. In 2003 and 2004, Brent and his brother Craig, we call them the Renaud brothers all the time at the firehouse, they're both from Arkansas, embedded with the Arkansas National Guard as they were deployed to Iraq. After months of filming, the brothers produced the 10-part documentary series Off to War, From Rural Arkansas to Iraq. They did it for Discovery Channel.
Mama, mama, can't you see?
Mama, mama, can't you see?
What this army do to me?
What this army do to me?
As the war in Iraq enters its second year, nearly 3,000 soldiers from the Arkansas National Guard are called to active duty.
Most of these guys, before we got activated, held a civilian job.
If the turkey houses get sold, then so be it. It's out of my hands right now.
I don't want him to go.
Yeah, they're going to target you because they think you're just a bunch of lazy, fat National Guardsmen who don't know how to do their job.
These soldiers are part of the largest deployment of National Guardsmen since the Korean War.
The military has confirmed that 4 Arkansas soldiers are killed in Iraq this weekend.
57 of the Arkansas Guardsmen come from the town of Clarksville. This is their story as they leave home and family behind to serve in Iraq.
That's an excerpt of Off to War, directed by Brent Renaud and his brother Craig. This is another clip featuring Sergeant David Short of the Arkansas National Guard.
Fit up and go out on a mission today. What we're supposed to be doing is security and stability operations, which we basically have just tossed that out the window. There's no security here and there is no stability here. You know, it's basically a full-fledged, very hot combat zone. All right, guys, let's go ahead and move on out. Another wonderful day. Shot anywhere with 50 cal and not be seriously wounded.
The ensuing fire resulted in 3 Iraqis killed, 7 seriously wounded.
The people are going to be pissed off that we shot a bunch of innocent people.
Any children or women?
I think there was a woman in the rear vehicle who went into labor.
I think this stuff is crazy, man. I really don't want to be here.
Unfortunate, but got to know that we're serious about this. We're getting our people killed and somebody wants to jump out with a toy pistol and start brandishing it like he's a big boy. He's going to get treated like a big boy. Lock and load, gentlemen. Okay, let the good times roll. I'm not into going out meeting the people, you know, pressing the flesh, you know, trying to help them out. time to see what their needs are because they won't quit attacking me long enough for me to find out what their needs are. I really wish we'd have trained more for combat operations. Train for the worst and expect the best. Well, we trained for the best and the worst happened.
An excerpt from the documentary series Off to War, From Rural Arkansas to Iraq, directed by Brent and Craig Renaud. In 2004, the Renaud brothers appeared on Democracy Now! Several times to talk about their time embedded with the Arkansas National Guard. This is Brent Renaud.
We arrived in Baghdad with a National Brent. Guard unit, with the Arkansas National Guard, in these same sort of unarmored vehicles. Right away in April, which was one of the bloodiest months of the war, when we arrived, there were, right off the battle, a lot of injuries and deaths, particularly with Echo Troop, who you just saw on the clip. Within that group, there were a number of guys who refused to go out on missions almost immediately after they had seen their friends and their fellow soldiers die right in front of them. Fortunately for them, Sergeant Short, who you see in the clip, the one talking in the Humvee, handled it internally, gave them time off, allowed them to get it together and to get back on the job. But I would say right off the bat, I witnessed about 3 to 4 guys who were just saying it's too dangerous to go out there. We're dropping like flies, as you also heard it in the clip. And this is pretty widespread sentiment.
I think it's something new to the American public when these National Guardsmen are saying we're not going to go because we don't have the armored vehicles. What do they mean?
Well, the way it works is that you, with the units, when they go over to Iraq, bring their own vehicles from their home state. A lot of them, most of them, were never in combat. They were doing things like, you know, helping people after floods, cleaning up after tornadoes. They didn't have combat-ready vehicles. But since every unit brought their vehicles with them into Iraq, at least initially, that's the vehicles that they had to do their missions with. And the regular Army, by and large, took their vehicles back to the United States with them.
That was Brent Renaud speaking on Democracy Now! In 2004, when we all worked at the firehouse at Downtown Community Television. Brent was killed yesterday in Ukraine, where he was working on a documentary about global refugees. That interview, yes, took place at the firehouse, which housed for many years both Democracy Now! And the whole DC TV crew, including Brent. See, Brent began his career with Downtown Community Television. We're joined now by Cora Weiss. She's the former chair of the DC TV Board of Directors, a position she held for 40 years. She was also president of the Hague Appeal for Peace and has been nominated 5 times for the Nobel Peace Prize for her work in the international women's and peace movements, particularly focusing on relations between the United States and Russia, at the time the Soviet Union. Cora, our condolences. We just played those clips of Off to War that the Renaud brothers did. They lived at your house in Bridgehampton for a year working on that series. Can you talk about, first, your response to hearing the news and what Brent and his work has meant and how it epitomizes independent media that came out of your Downtown Community Television founded by John Alpert, the great filmmaker?
Thank you, Amy. And first, I'd like to express my feelings about this unbearable crime of killing Brent to his parents and his brother, Craig. Brent and Craig lived in a summer house. That means it wasn't built to sustain a winter weather. They lived there for almost a year, editing Off to War. And we got to know 2 remarkable human beings. Brent spent his life working in film, trying to teach us all the truth about the evils, dangers, horrors of war. And it inspired my work for peace. Brent's loss is huge, absolutely huge, and it was unnecessary because this war is unnecessary.
I mean, you cross so many bridges. In fact, one of the works that the Reneau brothers did, one of their films was The Bridge to Baghdad. And they went together with our colleague, Sharif Abdelkaddous, in 2003 to Iraq to make that. And, Cora, you are the epitome of building bridges. So if you can talk about where Brent's life was ended in Ukraine. All the details are not exactly clear yet. This horrific moment where he was stopped at a checkpoint with Juan Arredondo, his colleague, and then he was shot dead and left in the road. If you can talk about how, if you see parallels between what is happening now between Ukraine, Russia, the United States, and NATO. You so long fought for peace. And what he was doing back then, covering the war in Iraq, the horror of the U.S. invasion.
The Iraq war was built on a lie about weapons of mass destruction. It was unnecessary. It was avoidable. All of the wars since the end of the Second World War should never have happened. And it was possible that they didn't have to happen because we've also become very experienced in diplomacy, and we've learned an enormous amount about prevention of violent conflict. And there are laws about preventing violent conflict. So this didn't have to happen. I don't know anything about where or why he was killed, but he shouldn't have been killed. Brent was terribly important as an educator for all Americans to understand the horrors of war and the unnecessary expense in life, in lives, and in money for the wars. So, you know, when you've spent your life trying to prevent war and this happens, you feel pretty discouraged. But I guess we can't afford to be, and we just have to keep trying, because war doesn't help anyone except the weapons manufacturers, who are probably the only happy people in the world today. We're using so many weapons, which destroy the construction workers, not workers, but the construction owners who will have to repair the damage are probably pretty happy too.
Cora Weiss, you began.
Otherwise.
You began your work in 1961. Your work for the abolition of nuclear weapons. And fighting for the ending of the Cold War. How concerned are you about the prospect of a nuclear war or an accident that could lead to this?
As long as there are nuclear weapons, and as long as people like President Biden and Putin say nothing is off the table, there is a possibility that they could be used, either used because of an accident or deliberately. And that is the most frightening thought, because we know that all it takes is one nuclear bomb and it's goodbye. Goodbye everything. You know, we talk about climate change. Climate change and nuclear weapons are the apocalyptic twins. And we have to prevent one and get rid of the other. We have to abolish nuclear weapons immediately. There should be no question about it anymore. They're too dangerous and unnecessary. And who wants to destroy the world and the lives of everybody in it?
I want to turn now to Last Chance High. That was the film that Brent and Craig Reneau won a Peabody for in 2014. This is Brent speaking at the Peabody Awards ceremony.
When Mark Allen, a development producer at Vice, brought us in to meet with Jason Mojica and hear about his plans to launch Vice News, we pitched a project we didn't really expect that they would greenlight, a multi-episode series that would take almost a year to produce about a Chicago school for kids with severe emotional and behavioral disorders. It's a school that the principal described as the last stop between jail, the mental institution, or the city morgue. But I remember vividly Jason saying this was exactly the kind of storytelling that Vice News was going to become known for. Over the last decade, more people have been killed in the city of Chicago by gun violence than U.S. soldiers fighting in Iraq or Afghanistan. Most of these shootings involve teenagers. Last Chance High is about what we feel is a severely underreported correlation between mental and behavioral disorders and the tragedy of youth violence.
That was Brent Renaud.
Brilliant.
Speaking.
Brent was brilliant.
Cora, can you wrap up by talking about what his work meant? Whether he was in Somalia or detained in China, whether he was in Colombia or he was back in his beloved Arkansas, whether he was in Mexico, in Egypt, whether he was in Iraq, his philosophy of filmmaking.
Brent spent his life helping us to understand the evils of war, the unnecessary wars that, and the destruction, not just to property, but to people, how it destroyed our minds, our lives, our children. And he did it unceasingly. He just did war, 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 no more, no more, no more. And that's a huge loss for all of us. We should all see Brent's films over and again. The 10-part series that he and Craig did and edited at our house for a year almost is unique. Nobody's ever made a film with such detail and through the perspective of the young men who are being asked to go and kill and fight it, and now women too, of course. So his loss is enormous, and it's a tragedy that should not happen again. Another mother and father should not have to bury their kid because of a war that didn't have to happen.
Well, in denouncing the shooting, the Committee to Protect Journalists called for the killers to be brought to justice. We're joined now by Carlos Martinez de la Serna, journalist and program manager for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Thank you so much for being with us, Carlos. Can you talk about what you understand at this point happened to Brent? And if you can talk about what other journalists are facing right now, whether in Russia or in Ukraine.
Sure. Thanks for having me. So, piecing together some of the information that was made public yesterday, different testimonies, including Juana Redondo's own testimony from the hospital. But we understand as Juan described, they were going through a checkpoint, moving from one place to another in the city of Irpin. That's northern Ukraine, very close to the capital city of Kiev. And at some point during that process, they were shot at, and then Brent was hit in the neck, I believe, and was left behind. As one said, there's a testimony of a journalist who passed by the body later. He described as a body there, covered by a blanket, and then others were rushed to the hospital as one. Those are the two journalists that we know were affected by the attack. There's a police report from Ukrainian police that says that there were responsibles were Russian troops That's the only report we've seen so far, we've mentioned so far. There's still details missing, so we cannot categorically say who's responsible for the killing. What we can do definitely right now is reiterate and clearly emphasize what are kind of the rules of war, if there's such, regarding journalists. So journalists under international humanitarian law are civilians, and civilians are never a legitimate target. So what happened to Bren amounts, at least in paper, as of today, as a war crime. That's the situation that civilians in Ukraine are facing all the time. This is a war where there are so many places under attack, and those are changing all the time. The situation is extremely threatening to civilians, as of course, as well as other people as well, but I'm focused on civilians, and journalists are civilians as well. So they're exposed to attacks like this all the time. Yesterday, there were reports about the city of Irpin being banned from reporters after this killing of Brennan, the incident. So this situation is changing all the time. Journalists need help and advice when they're just trying to move from one place to another. It's extremely fluid and extremely dangerous.
Carlos, can you talk about what happened on February 28th, Russian soldiers firing on a team from Sky News in the Kyiv region, the capital region?
Yeah, that's one of the reports that clearly seems very similar to what happened here. They were reporting there was a TV crew from Sky News, and they were filming. So you can clearly see how they came under attack. And they were shot at by, it seems, Russian troops. There are other reports as well. At the beginning of the war, which seems years ago, but it's only 3 weeks, there were two Danish journalists that were also shot at, and they recovered, and I believe they left the country.
Yes, I watched them interviewed from a hospital outside the country.
Yes, so they're back in Denmark. And the report of a Swiss journalist, freelancer, who also was attacked and allegedly robbed by Russian troops. There are many incidents. There's a Ukrainian journalist that was killed in the shelling of a communications tower in Kyiv.
And, of course, so often it's the local journalists who face the most danger.
That is. So most of the journalists killed in conflict are usually local journalists, and also journalists killed because of other reasons are also used. I mean, not other settings. There are never reason to call journalists, but other settings, other circumstances are usually local journalists.
Carlos, but also we have to go. But I just want to ask, what are you calling for now?
There needs to be a credible, transparent investigation, and whoever is responsible for this needs to be held accountable. This amounts to a war crime. This is the justice in this case and in other cases called journalists is essential to really bring things to a place where we can see, well, there's some kind of closure despite the tragic event, the loss for the family, the loss for the journalism community, and the loss for the public. Brent did an amazing work that he won't be able to continue. And as you said before, his testimony has been so powerful, as well as other journalists. We need to protect the other journalists by bringing those who are responsible for Brent's kills to justice.
Carlos Martinez de la Serna, I want to thank you for being with us, journalist and program manager for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Coming up is NATO accuses Russia of flying warplanes out of Belarus. We'll speak to a leading Belarusian activist who's living in exile about the Russian invasion and the escalating repression inside Belarus. Stay with us.
And you always the love that's true always. When the things you've planned need a helping hand, I will understand and always, always. Days may not be fair, always. That's when I'll be there, always. Not for just an hour.
Always by Willie Nelson and his sister and pianist Bobby Nelson. Bobby died Thursday at the age of 91. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we turn now to look at the role of Belarus. On Friday, the Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko, met with Russian President Vladimir Putin at the Kremlin. The meeting came a day after a NATO official accused Russia of flying warplanes from airfields in Belarus. Prior to the invasion of Ukraine, Putin stationed thousands of Russian troops in Belarus. These troops then took part in the invasion of Ukraine from the north. Ukrainian officials have expressed concern Belarus may soon send troops into Ukraine and become directly involved in the war. We're joined now by Natalia Satsankevich. She works with the human rights group Vyazna, which is one of the top independent human rights organizations in Belarus. Vyazna means spring in Belarusian. Seven Vyazna of the group's members are detained for their work. In 2020, the group received the Right Livelihood Award, the Alternative Nobel Peace Prize, for, quote, their resolute struggle for realization of democracy and human rights in Belarus. Natalia is joining us from Lithuania. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you describe the situation in Belarus for people to understand it being used as a major staging ground for Russia's invasion of Ukraine? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. If you could start again. You might be talking, but I can't hear you, so I need to get a... Well, let me go to, while we check your sound, the Belarusian Foreign Minister Vladimir Makey.
Can you speak. Hear me?
I hear you right now. Okay, we will go right to you. Can you describe the role of Belarus in the invasion, Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for your interest for Belarus in this topic. And that's a pretty hard question for Belarusians and civil society of Belarus, and of course, human rights organizations, because we work a lot with Ukrainian colleagues and we see the situation and we all know, see and understand that the territory of Belarus is used for conducting the war against Ukraine. And but we see from the first day of the war that there are a lot of protests in Belarus from people against the war and participation of Belarus there. And they were arrested up to 1,000 people around the whole country protesting against the war. And also there are even criminal cases when people started criticizing Belarusian authorities about their actions and participation in the war. And also, I think that the main problem between these negotiations between Putin and Lukashenko is that Belarusian people, they do not know what is the sense and details of these meetings. Yeah, we can't influence on Alexander Lukashenko on decisions. And there is no possibility to express your opinion now in Belarus and to influence on the situation and even any attempt to exercise your rights in Belarus now is strongly repressed by authorities. It started in summer 2020 until today the situation goes only worse and worse.
Can you tell us about your colleagues in prison right now with Vyazna?
Sure. Today is exactly 8 months, and they were, as three of my colleagues were arrested, and they still now at pretrial detention center, and we don't know any details of their criminal case because nobody tells us the details. And we see that there is an investigation, but it's not very active. And actually, they are like blamed in doing a financial crime, but these repressions about human rights defenders from Vesna, it's only because of their human rights job. And I also would like to remind that my colleague, coordinator of volunteers, Marfa Rabkova, she was arrested in September of 2020. So about a year and a half, she's in prison waiting for a court trial. And she faced up to 20 years. She could receive up to 12 years of prison. And there are more than 1,000 of political prisoners in Belarus. And the conditions where they stay, they're awful. It influences extremely on their health. And there is at least one case when a person died in Belarusian prison, a political prisoner. So I really call you to keep in focus this topic also, political prisoners in Belarus, and to spread this information, to show your solidarity, and to support them by sending letters and postcards of solidarity from all countries from the world.
Natalia, can you talk about the latest referendum held just last week, and the referendum opening the door for Russia to station nuclear weapons in Belarus, and the significance of this?
The results of this referendum, it was like, as we expected, unfortunately. The whole process was done in this atmosphere of fear and repression. And those people who tried to protest against the results of the referendum, they were arrested on Sunday, on the elections day. And also, there were no free media, no access to any information except propaganda, state propaganda. And of course, we can't rely on the results. And this referendum, as all previous elections in Belarus, they were no free, no fair, and it's not the result of people's voting.
And the repression in Belarus after and during the protests that began in 2020, and Russia's role in the suppression of those protests?
Of course, we see that the Lukashenko regime is so strong because of the support of Russia and Putin personally. We do not see Russian forced agencies in Belarus. I mean, during the protests in August 2020 and later, but we know that it could happen. And that's very strange situation when one state influences so much on other independent state.
We're going to do part two of this conversation. It's so rare to speak to someone from Belarus. You have left the country. We're speaking to you now in Vilnius, Lithuania. Natalia Satsankevich is with the Belarusian human rights group Vyasna. Part two will be at democracynow.org. We dedicate today's show to our colleague, Brent Renaud, and to all those who've died during this invasion. He went to Ukraine to document the refugees from Ukraine and global refugees around the world. That does it for our show, Democracy Now! Accepting job applications for Human Resources Manager. Check out democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Felsmeitberg, Messiah Rhodes, Amin Sheikh, Maria Tersena, Tamri Warnoff, Camille Baker, Sam Alkoff, Tamria Studio. Special thanks to John Alpert and Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman.
RCT, In Sound, from Way Out.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Peter Kuznick, professor of history at American University and director of the university's nuclear studies program.
Nuclear war is a central question facing all of us right now. Stay tuned.
We also speak today with Professor Karina Mullen, a political economist.
What are the nuts and bolts behind all of what's going on now in Ukraine? She knows. Listen in.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
The Nuremberg Tribunal called aggression, quote, the supreme international crime, end quote, because it contains within it all other crimes. German Nazi leaders were tried, convicted, and hung at Nuremberg for the German war of aggression. They began in September of 1939 when they invaded Poland and started World War II. The guilty verdicts at Nuremberg were not merely victor's justice. Its precepts were incorporated into the UN Charter. The Charter, which is a treaty ratified by the countries of the world, established a process for keeping the peace and, quote, to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, close quote. War is outlawed, with the only exception being self-defense after an armed attack or with the permission of the Security Council of the United Nations. Russia is guilty of aggression against the Ukraine. But that being said, the United States has baited the Russian bear repeatedly, starting in 1990 with the breakup of the Soviet Union. At that time, U.S. Secretary of State James Baker promised the Russian leader Mikhail Gorbachev that the U.S.-led NATO organization would not move, quote, one inch, close quote, east towards Russia. This promise was broken. The Russians were betrayed. Since then, NATO has recruited 11 former Soviet bloc and Warsaw Pact countries into its military organization. Led by the United States, NATO is an organization that has played an aggressive role, having carried out the bombings of Serbia, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, and Libya. NATO has placed missiles in Poland within 100 miles of the Russian border. Missiles on the long border between the Ukraine and Russia could hit Moscow in 10 minutes, making it impossible for the Russians to defend themselves. Russia's attempt to make the United States understand they have crossed a red line has been consistently rejected. This is not to defend Russia's actions, but to place them in historical context. The world now has come to the edge of an abyss.